Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Tuesday. It is, I have to think about it. Yes, it's Tuesday, the 17th of September, and we welcome you to the program. Thank you very much for being with us. It is very gratifying to have you listening to us, whether you're doing it live or if it's a couple hours after we broadcast this and you have a podcast in the car or listening to streaming or however you are hearing us. We are just grateful that you are with us and that you are part of the ride here. We have a lot to discuss this morning. We'll get into it in just a moment, and I'll introduce our group by just a quick announcement that on Thursday we are having our DEI panel, which is happening at the Linda. This is our show for Thursday morning. We'll be on the subject of diversity, equity, and inclusion. We have an amazing panel of individuals who will be joining us, and they're going to be talking about all facets of DEI. The two cool things about this, besides just the enormity of the quality of guests that we have, is that we are going to be at the Linda live in front of an audience, and that audience welcomes you. We would love for you to be a part of it. Two, it is a fundraiser for WAMC, and it is for our October lockbox. And the fund drive is coming. We're trying to fill the lockbox as much as we possibly can. And whatever you can do today and get a ticket or find out more about the program, we'd love for you to do that. All you have to do is go to WAMC.org. And if you want tickets, they're $75 a piece, $75. And you just go to the drop-down menu and you'll see it there. If you have any questions, you can either put it in your comment box or you can call 1-800-323-9262. We welcome you. We couldn't be more excited to do this program and couldn't be more excited to have all of you with us as we join together to talk about this important topic on Thursday morning. WAMC.org. All right, let's talk about what we've got to talk about today. And a lot going on, and even some stories that I'm going to have to sneak in on the panel. I didn't maybe necessarily tell them they were going to be our stories because there are some things overnight that I want to add to the equation. But I'm very pleased to welcome the following individuals to the program. Stuart Rice, Honorary Chair at the University of Massachusetts Amherst College of Information and Computer Sciences and Faculty Associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Fran Berman is here.
Good morning.
Hello, Fran. How are you?
I am good. How are you?
I'm well. I'm very well. I was a week ago, talking to a friend of yours who wanted me to tell you hello and that she misses you, and that was Jill Lepore.
Oh, my God. Jill is so wonderful.
Yeah.
That's great. And you must have had a blast talking to her.
You know, she's a little smart.
Yeah.
My
we were Radcliffe
God.
Fellows together, and when she published her book on data science, If Then, we got to do a really fun interview. I was the interviewer, and she was the interviewee, and we got to do that for Harvard Data Science Review. We had a blast.
Yeah, she was very, very warm when I mentioned your name, and very excited and that we were friends. And so, I just wanted to pass that along to you. But Fran Berman, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Jay Jochnowitz joins us, semi-retired editor at large, columnist, editorial writer from the Times Union. Jay, good morning. How are you?
I am well, and I'm interested in what extra topics we have and whether I know anything about them, but I can say with confidence that if we have to get creative, Joe, to talk about the issues that matter to the American people, We will do that.
Yeah, we do what we have to do. Right? That's basically what it is that we. Sometimes we just have to make these sacrifices and go and do these things. We also welcome Mike Spain to the program, former Times Union Associate Editor, and it's wonderful to have Mike back. He was with us yesterday. He's with us today, and we couldn't be more thrilled. Good morning. How are you?
I'm great. Very happy to be here on this beautiful day and looking forward to the topics that are before us.
Yes. Well, obviously, we have the, I said obvious, we have some obvious ones that we start off with. And that is all mostly in regards to the assassination attempt that happened over the weekend at the Trump International Golf Course in Palm Beach, Florida. The Secret Service admits not searching the golf course perimeter yesterday. The agency's acting director, Ronald Rowe, praised his agent's actions but conceded that there was no sweep of the course at Donald Trump's club that a gunman had staked out. We are being told that, according to cell phone records, that he had been there for anywhere from 12 to 20 hours prior, probably closer to 12, getting there in the wee hours of the morning prior to the 1:30-ish time where there was actually the conflict between agents and the would-be shooter, who did not fire his gun, it was said yesterday. The Secret Service did not search the perimeter of the Trump International Golf Club before President Donald Trump began his round, an acknowledgement that has put the besieged agency under renewed scrutiny 2 months after a similar episode in Butler, Pennsylvania. The decision raises further questions about whether the Secret Service has the resources and the ability to adequately perform its duties during a time of increasing violence and a unique campaign between a sitting president, a sitting vice president, and a former president. While the agency's acting director hailed a Secret Service agent for acting swiftly and preventing any harm to Mr. Trump on Sunday, which I think we can't lose sight of, they did their job in the sense of no shots were fired and no one was hurt in the incident on Sunday. The FBI said that their data from a gunman's cell phone indicated he spent over 12 hours near the course before he aimed a rifle in the direction of Mr. Trump while he was golfing. In remarks to reporters at the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office on Monday afternoon, Ronald Rowe, the acting director, said the president wasn't even really supposed to go there. Mr. Rowe said Trump, the Republican presidential nominee, did not have an outing on the course on his official schedule. Mr. Rowe did not clarify in his statements whether this meant that agents did not have time to sweep the golf course, yet it is public knowledge that Mr. Trump frequently plays golf at one of his Florida courses on Sundays, raising the risk level for the former president. Mr. Rowe praised his agents for spotting the barrel of the gun poking through the bushes of the golf club and firing at the suspect, Ryan Routh, who is 58 years old, before he could get off a shot. A manhunt commenced, leading to Mr. Routh being detained soon after. He was about 40 miles away from the site when they found him. He was charged in federal court on Monday with the possession of a firearm as a felon. Other charges, of course, are expected. The Secret Service's methods were effective yesterday, Mr. Rowe said. He pointed to early identification of the threat and immediate evacuation of Mr. Trump and the help of increased protective measures. But after Sunday's episode, legislators, law enforcement officials, and the Secret Service alumni questioned whether the embattled agency was still up to its mission of protecting current and former presidents and their families. So let us begin, Mike Spain, with you. Well, that's concerning.
Well, it is. You know, there will be lots of criticisms of the Secret Service in the coming days, already is. Are they doing enough? Are they capable of doing more? Do they have the resources to do more? What should have they been doing instead of what happened? But you made a good point, Joe, and that is that it worked. They were working ahead of the president's playing of golf, you know, and they did see this this person pointing a gun, and they, you know, essentially stopped that and then later caught the individual. And that's a good thing. That is what's supposed to happen. Now the question is, should have they done a whole perimeter canvas earlier? Should they have more people out there? There's some question about if he had been a sitting president, would they have had more people there? And then, you know, I don't know that it's a big excuse that Trump didn't have the golf outing on his official schedule. You can probably bank on it being there anyway. They probably knew he would be playing golf because that's what he does when he's home on weekends, like a lot of Americans. And only he does it with a little more, perhaps there's a bigger entourage. And
he owns the course.
Now, I think it's the Washington Post had a story today saying that the Secret Service has been saying for a long time that it's very difficult to protect someone while they're playing golf because so often golf courses are surrounded by communities where there's, even though there's fences, there's access to see, and where there's access to see, I guess there's access to use a high-powered rifle, and it's just a risky situation they don't really like. That's why President Obama, when he was in office and he would play golf, which was about one-fifth as many times as Trump, although Trump did complain that Obama was off playing golf too much when he was running for president himself. Obama would play at military golf courses because they were more secure and easier to prevent any onlookers from coming onto the course. Because there are a lot of people that do want to see a president, and they stand by fences, and they just want to get a glimpse. And you know, the Secret Service. What I was surprised about this story in the New York Times that you've been reading from, it says that the Secret Service has to guard more than 40 people in government. It's not just the president and the vice president. They have to do the former presidents, former first ladies. They have to do other top officials. And then when anybody comes in, any diplomats or very high-ranking people, foreign leaders come to the U.S., they have an enormous task of protecting them and making sure that all the routes are secure, et cetera. So it's a lot, and it's not easy to just say, here, have some more money and fix this tomorrow. You know, there's a lot of training, a lot of logistics to it. And Congress hasn't provided that that blank check for them. And President Biden yesterday kind of said, maybe you should. Maybe we should fix this and at least get the process going.
Fran Berman.
I think on the local level, there's questions about, you know, how far away do you need to sweep it and what's the perimeter? And in this case, there was the perimeter was smaller than where this guy was. And but it sounds like the Secret Service largely did their job. And the thing that concerns me about this story and the story in general is something I don't really have an answer to, which is this kind of environment of violence. And the environment where, you know, guns continue to be okay and pretty prevalent in our society means that every time we want to let off a little steam, this is more and more one of the options. And no one deserves to get shot. And I think it's really terrible that people are shooting at Trump or anyone else. But, you know, in some sense, Trump is part of the team making this bed. And, you know, here's a guy who, in addition to many other people, is feeding that environment of violence. feeds that environment where, you know, guns are okay and acceptable and the right solution for many jobs. And so that's the part that gets me, Joe. You know, I think about, can we put more money behind the Secret Service? Because they have a lot of people to protect. Sure. You know, can we widen the perimeter? Sure. Can we train them better? Sure. We can do all of those things. But, you know, ultimately, how far of a perimeter do we need to really keep people safe? Because we're not as safe anymore as we used to be. And it's not about the Secret Service. It's about a lot of things. So, you know, I don't want to be the bummer for today's show, but I have no good answers for that. And right. It really, really concerns me. You know, even think about sending your kids to school. You know, kids and parents and teachers and principals and all kinds of other people, they worry about that stuff now. Where, when I was going to school, when my kids were going to school, this was not something we thought about.
Pause you there, and when we come back, we'll hear the rest of your thoughts. Go to Jay as well. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Fran Berman, Jay Jochnowitz, and Mike Spain. Right before we were going to break, we were talking about the story having to do with the Secret Service coming under scrutiny because of the second attempt of an assassination on former President Donald Trump in as many months. And Fran, just as we were going to a break, I think you were making a great point, which is it's not so much it obviously is our world and greater factors at play here, not just the Secret Service, but this penchant for violence. And the last words that you were speaking just before we had to go to a break was that this is the same way that parents feel in sending their kids to school.
Yeah, I, you know, where's this going to end? I mean, the problem, I used to think that I understood that we were at a choice point and that the future had a lot of viable options, some of which I found more positive than others. But when you look at things like this, I really don't understand how it's going to end. We've had these over and over and over again, including the attempts on Trump. These really tragic situations where people, you know, haul out a gun somewhere and try to or do shoot people, including school children, and or people in movie theaters or people in malls. And I don't know where this is going to end because that level of violence doesn't seem to have dissuaded us. It doesn't seem to have helped us beat the lobbies. It doesn't seem to have done really much of anything. And so I don't know. Sorry to be a bummer, all of you. And hopefully you can all say, no, Fran, what about this? And this is what I need that will bring me hope. But so when I hear a story like this, it should never be more of the same, but it feels a little like that.
Jay Jochnowitz.
Yeah, Fran, I don't think you're a bummer, any more of a bummer than the reality is. You know, I have the same reaction to this that I, in a kind of abstract way, that I do whenever there's a school shooting. It's that we are just going to go through the motions of the same narrative that we are locked in as a nation. And, you know, you can call the shot, you know, you can call the shots that are going to come, so to speak. And it's so discouraging. And I have such a sense of futility about it sometimes that I agree with you that there were, it was a few years ago, I think, you know, around the time of some of the worst shootings we've seen in this country, one after another, over a period of several years that I thought, we're going to wake up. It's going to happen. And no, as Gabby Giffords wrote in a piece in the Times today, you probably didn't even hear about some of the shootings. You probably don't even know about some of the shootings that have happened in the last few days, or the lockdowns that have occurred in the last few days, or the fact that kids are staying home from school because school officials are worried about something that might happen. I filled up half a notebook page just sitting here now with all the different things that need to be talked about with this. And it's the same thing every time. What really discourages me, I think, more than anything, is that ultimately this is going to get churned through a political mill. And now it's happening on both sides. I actually had Facebook friends who I consider to be perfectly sane people posting memes about how did he know to be at that golf course, on that particular day when there wasn't a public announcement of it. So now we got a conspiracy theory on the left that maybe Trump set this up, to get himself shot. And I heard this about Butler as well. And now Elon Musk with his post about, what isn't it interesting?
Why isn't anybody
shot Kamala Harris? This is so weird, and yet it's not, because it is what we go through. And the same thing is going to happen, I predict, with the Secret Service, that we're going to hear that it's the Republicans' fault that we've underfunded the Secret Service, and it's the Democrats' fault that we underfunded the Secret Service, and so on and so on and so on. And yeah, I guess, yes, Fran, it is a bummer. But you are not to blame for it being a bummer. We are as a nation. And I think ultimately it comes to Gabby Giffords' point that there is one common thread through all of this. It's the gun. And I would like to know, and I'll stop blabbering, I would like to know what the felony charge is here, what the charge is about possessing a gun as a felon. How did he get this gun? I still haven't seen that article yet, or that detail about what felony he committed and how he got past the federal background check and how he obtained this gun.
The felony was back around 2003. He held up in a house with a machine gun, a full-level machine gun, and he was convicted of possessing a weapon of mass destruction.
Ah.
And how he got the gun, I don't think anyone has reported that yet.
That'd be interesting.
I mean, one of the weapons that he had Sunday evidently had the serial number scratched out, or that
right.
was part
that was
of
what
it.
I heard,
and
yeah.
That makes it even a greater crime by itself. But, sort of making it a ghost gun. But, there's so many guns out there. If he couldn't buy it legally, this fellow probably knew people based on his background who could get him guns under the table.
All right. We have a lot of letters on this, and I'll start with those, and we'll work through some of the other issues here. Trump will not be able to play golf on a whim. Security needs time to comb the area, which probably will take a couple of hours. So that means Trump will need to play golf on a schedule. High-tech surveillance would probably work, and who would pay for that? Trump is making himself more vulnerable by still having outdoor rallies. All of that, I think, is true. When you look at the map, I felt the same way when right after Butler. You look at the overhead drone shot and you say, okay, so this was outside the perimeter. How did that guy with a gun get on top of the roof in a line of sight, even though people were telling agents that there was a guy with a gun going up on a ladder? That... How does that happen?
A building that was a staging area for police.
Correct. Also,
unbelievable.
Then when you look at the overhead pictures of, and this isn't to foster any conspiracy theory at all, but you have the golf course, you look at the overhead of the golf course. It is a road, a chain link fence, bushes, chain link fence, and bushes. and you think to yourself, oh, well, that's not very much. And I said this yesterday, but I wondered about it. There was a time when they're making a lot about Trump golfing, and the press was kept on trying to get a good picture of him golfing. And then you realize that, oh, well, there were all these spots. And that just seems odd to me as well. And the other thing I think that is somewhat underreported here, and I don't know how you all feel about it, but they keep on talking about the gun having the capacity to hit Trump where he was at that moment.
Something like 400 yards.
Right.
Yeah.
But the plan apparently was when he went to the next hole. I mean, that's when the agent went to the next hole in advance, saw the gun sticking out. That's presumably where
Trump would have been much closer.
A shooting potentially would have taken place. So I think that's something to keep in mind as well. All right, letters. Aren't there drones that can control areas with cameras to view what goes on? Yes, I guess this gets into the...
There absolutely are.
Yeah.
There absolutely are.
So this gets into the...
And then the question is, whose drone is it, right? If you have a drone out there, how do we know it's our drone versus somebody else's drone versus a drone that's equipped to, shoot versus one that isn't? I mean, there's a lot of detail to drones.
That's right. I mean, if there's drones allowed where there's an outdoor event involving a presidential candidate, that could be very suspicious. And whose drone is it? In this particular case, I looked at that map also that you're talking about, Joe, and it's like right by the airport. And you can't usually have drones around airports because they collide with planes and things, you know. I mean, it's a good idea to use all the technology that's available the best way you can to screen the area. And sometimes drones may be useful and sometimes less useful.
Betsy writes, I have seen no reporting about security that Trump might have on his property, security cameras, security personnel of his own. Wouldn't it behoove the former president to have security cameras installed around his golf course and have staff monitor them? It seems logical he could spend some of his great fortune on that and call it a business expense. I would find it very difficult to believe that it is not already heavily secure, but I think there's a difference between that level of security and the level of security that is going to keep someone alive in a shooting incident.
I would also, this is going to not be kind, but I would suspect that if there is going to be security installed at Trump's golf courses, he's going to find a way to make the government pay for it, that he's going to say that this is a Secret Service expense, the same way that he, charged the market rates that nobody gets charged at his hotels and his resorts so the Secret Service can stay there and he can make money off them. So that's how he'll do it. But to the writer's point, yes, probably, and yours, Joe, I think the security probably does need to be upgraded to places he frequents.
You know, there's a point that nobody likes to admit, and that is, I mean, this particular fellow had a GoPro camera there set up to record the what's likely to have been an assassination attempt and perhaps an assassination of a political figure. He's active on social media. I think this is not a scientific term, but I believe the guy is probably some kind of a lunatic. And if a lunatic doesn't care about whether he, what happens to him and he wants to go out with a blaze of glory, it is extraordinarily challenging. And I, I can acknowledge the errors that the Secret Service may have made, but I mean, it is a challenge.
John doesn't use the word lunatic. John uses the word wacko.
Oh.
And he says, when you...
None of which are technical terms, I have to say.
Absolutely. When you inspire wackos to follow you, beware when you disappoint them. writes John. But of course, the big problem is gun control. You inspire violence, you could die by violence. That from John. Then, Amber says, it seems that the current level of violence in our country has reached a point that is so intolerable or even unbelievable that many can do nothing other than to deny reality and look to place blame anywhere else but with the system that has perpetuated it.
I just agree with that. I mean, that's what we've been talking about. These are specific problems to this situation, but at their heart, they're systemic problems. And changing a system, any system, is really, really, really hard. And when people do, I mean, I don't know as much about the Australian, you know, gun control situation as I would like to, but you see the numbers. And you see sort of a tempering of at least that part of civil engagement.
Right.
In this day and age, we could use a little of that.
I had the opportunity to sit and ask questions to and talk with the Australian ambassador some years ago, Joe Hockey. And that was one of the questions he was asked about it was a dinner with journalists. And, you know, it's a weird thing. It was essentially, he said, this was not a huge debate. And he's a farmer. So, you know, he needs guns. He needs at least a gun on his farm. But he said, look, you know, you make concessions to this. This was a national consensus. We were horrified by a mass shooting, and it was not that big a deal to say, you know what, we need to control guns in this country. This is not going to happen in the United States in the current environment or any immediate future one that I can see.
We're late for a break. We'll go take that, and when we come back, we'll continue this conversation. We welcome your letters. We have many to go to now. We welcome yours, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Just a few more letters, and then I'm going to change the subject just slightly. And that is one letter from James, who says, since he didn't fire a shot, it seems to me that he was just exercising his right to bear arms under the Second Amendment. Then we go to Paul. Two reports raise a question. The choice to play there when there was a last-minute decision, but Ralph was in place for 12 hours. How did he know? Well, to me, that makes sense, which means that if you know that the president plays golf most Sundays at the golf course and you know he's in town, but you don't know when, so you camp out early, right? I don't know that that's as sinister as it sounds.
I don't think it is either. The idea that Trump would have said,
by the way,
him,
I have no idea. But just put that out there. But might be my guess.
But you should clarify. What he did was sinister, but probably didn't get inside information.
I'm guessing not.
All right. Let's see. We go to Gabby Giffords had it half right. There are two common threads to shootings, the gun and a white male shooter. In most cases. All right. Let's go to some other aspects to the story this morning. And again, we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. So now the blame game goes on, and this is, you know, I think a fairly major part of the story. Trump, this is the headline in the New York Times this morning, Trump using harsh language urges Democrats to tone down theirs. The authorities have not provided information about the gunman's motive in the apparent assassination attempt on Sunday, yet former President Donald Trump who has his own history of using violent language, sought to blame Democrats. Former President Trump on Monday claimed inflammatory language from Democrats had provoked what the authorities are investigating as an assassination attempt against him, urging his rivals to tone down their speech, even as he called them the enemy from within and the real threat. Hours later, Mr. Trump, in a social media post, sought to link both Sunday's incident and the attempt on his life in July to statements Vice President Kamala Harris has made and to the four criminal cases he is facing. The authorities have not yet publicly commented on a motive for the subject, who was arrested after fleeing Mr. Trump's golf course in West Palm Beach, Florida on Sunday. But Mr. Trump told Fox News Digital on Monday that the gunman believed the rhetoric of Biden and Harris and he acted on it. Mr. Trump, who often uses violent language and whose frequent lies about the 2020 election led some of his supporters to violently attack the Capitol on January 6th, predicted an increase in political violence in his post online, saying, "Because of this communist left rhetoric, the bullets are flying and it will only get worse." The statements come as he has also increasingly voiced suspicions about the attempt on his life at a rally in Butler, Pennsylvania in July, in which one attendee was killed, two others critically injured, and Mr. Trump was struck in the ear. Law enforcement officials have yet to identify the motives of the gunman in that shooting, who was killed by Secret Service agents. But Mr. Trump has recently pointed to President Biden and Ms. Harris. During his debate with Ms. Harris, he said that he probably took a bullet to the head because of the things that they say about me. Jay.
Well, the next thing he's going to do is portray all people who are on the side of Ukraine, which I suspect is, it sounds like this was an underlying issue for this guy, that he felt a great deal of sympathy for Ukraine, actually wanted to go fight and die there if necessary, even though he had no military experience to speak of. And, you know, it'll probably be, well, that's it. You know, the Russians are peaceful people, and the people who support Russia, like myself, are peaceful people. And it's the Ukrainians who really started this fight, the same way that, you know, January 6th was, you know, more and more being and is more and more being portrayed as a, you know, a peaceful demonstration that had a few, unfortunately, Antifa people there who stirred things up. And, you know, this is the nonsense that kind of adds to my feeling of despair when something like this happens, because you know that it's going to get churned through some crazy political narrative. And in this case, for Donald Trump to be suggesting that violent rhetoric, nasty rhetoric, as he likes to call it, against people, this is a daily occurrence with him to vilify people, vilify the left, vilify Harris, vilify Biden. You turn on talk radio, you're going to hear it within 5 minutes of being on there. You know, that it's the left that is violent, not the right. January 6th notwithstanding.
His quote yesterday during an online discussion, "We can't play games, so we can't have a Marxist communist president, because that's not what it's all about."
Right.
Fran.
Yes. First of all, I want to say the very best thing about this is Joe's masterful performance art reading of this non-news item. So, Joe, you did a really fabulous job in reading what I wonder, why is this news? I mean, there are so many articles where, you know, Trump says something crazy and everybody reports on it as if it were a serious thing, and it's not crazy. And, you know, tomorrow, if he changes his mind, or 5 minutes from now, if he changes his mind, then we're going to get something else. This is not news. It's just a report of still another misbehavior. My observed experiences that Trump's just going to lash out at anybody he possibly can, especially his perceived enemies, which is almost everybody, about whatever he's unhappy with. And he's always unhappy with something. So why some people, a fair number of people, think this is presidential, I don't know. And why this is news, I don't know. So thank you, Joe, for brightening my day by reading what I can only imagine is an article from The Onion, except it isn't. I don't know what to say about this. It's just crazy.
I think there is an impulse for journalists, and I think it's a valid impulse that you don't allow something like this, a false narrative like this, or an ironic narrative like this, to just stand on its own, because otherwise you're sort of allowing it to be...
To promulgate.
It's basically saying, well, it's true, you know, and we're just going to let it get churned through, you know, right-wing media and Fox. Well, one and the same. That this is going to stand as a valid thing to say if we don't report on it. And so you want to report on it, and you want to show this accusation from him stands in very sharp contrast to the way he talks all the time and the way people around him and his supporters talk all the time. The first person I thought of, I was scanning my email to see if Elise Stefanik has put out a statement yet, you know, blaming the Democrats, blaming the radical left agenda and
so
forth.
She did right after Sunday.
Yeah. I mean, it is a technique that of rhetoric, and I'm not a qualified rhetoric expert, but in my observations as a journalist, it's a technique to accuse your opponent of the very things that you are guilty of. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like almost in grade school, but it actually is effective, and that's what Trump is doing now. And yeah, I think back to his 2016 campaign when you know, somebody got up at a rally to challenge him, and he said, "Why don't you take that guy out and punch him, and I'll pay for your lawyer." You know, I mean, he has contributed to a culture of violent rhetoric that has, you take this individual on Sunday. I mean, he wasn't all that stable, so it appeals to non-stable people. Last summer, there was a guy who was a January 6th rioter, I think it was last June or July, who went to Barack Obama's private home in Washington, D.C., after Trump put out Obama's address, and he came loaded with firearms. I mean, how can that not be considered contributing to the violent, the violent nature and culture of things? He is accusing Harris and Biden, and you know, they zero in on statements that Trump is a threat to democracy that must be stopped, and they say that's it. They're telling people to take him down. No, I think they're legitimately saying elect me, not him. But everything Trump says, he's very clever. Has, you know, you could look at some arcane double meaning in what he says, and he'll turn something into something else, and people who follow him, they believe it. That's the way, sadly, it is.
We'll do the weave.
Well, I bow to your guys' journalistic wisdom, because it really, truly, what works with me is probably like your outlier anyway. I'm a scientist, right? I'm looking for evidence that any of the things that, or almost all of the things that Trump says are true or backed up by some kind of data or even show the complexity of the world we live in, for which very little is black and white. I mean, truly. And everything seems to have context and caveat and situations where it's kind of a behavior is okay and other situations where it's not. And I don't see any of that. So I read stuff like this, and I think, this is more sort of garbage in, garbage out.
We will hold there. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation, finish up with our group, Mike Spain, Jay Jochnowitz, and Fran Berman. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Ray Graff is next with news. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us on this Tuesday morning. It is the 17th of September, 10 minutes after 10 o'clock. We are joined by Fran Berman, Jay Jochnowitz, and Mike Spain making up the panel. And we welcome you to do the same. All you have to do is write to us, panel at WAMC.org, and we'd love to hear what is on your mind as we wind our way through the stories of the day. So let's go to another political story, this one closer to home. This is one of the stories that I've added to the docket, so I apologize to all. But it is, I thought it was an interesting story. And that is that Nancy Pelosi is blaming New York for House losses. Governor Hochul wants another chance. That's the headline. The New York governor has rebuilt the state Democratic Party to help flip key swing states in November. But can she staunch her own political bleeding? That is the question before us. In the bitter weeks after Democrats lost their House majority in 2022, party leaders search for explanations. There was painfully high inflation, qualms about the southern border. Nancy Pelosi, the former speaker, singled out a less predictable culprit, New York Governor Kathy Hochul. Ms. Pelosi argued the Democrats had lost five key races there because Ms. Hochul's lumbering campaign misjudged discontent about crime, pulling down the entire ticket. 2 years later, close allies of Ms. Hochul say she remains embarrassed and indignant over blame that she believes was unfairly cast. But her frustration is also fueling a decision this fall to put the full force of her governorship into proving that she and her state can set things right for Democrats. The governor has positioned the House races at the center of everything from her galloping fundraising schedule to state policymaking, most notably halting New York's most significant public transportation project in a generation, amid opposition to it from must-win suburbs. She's also trying to transform the state's Democratic Party from a perennial punching bag into a sophisticated turnout operation with 37 field offices and nearly 100 staff members, with a coordinated campaign in a partnership with Senator Kirsten Gillibrand and Representative Hakeem Jeffries, the House Minority Leader. Hochul has covered most of the $5 million price tag. And so this is where we are. And but there's also a more tactical objective. One of the Republican incumbents her party hopes to defeat, Representative Mike Waller, has made little secret of his eagerness for the state's top job. Defeating him now would help deny him a platform in 2 years. She gets the joke, Charlie King, a veteran Democratic strategist, said. There have been a number of missteps. We can acknowledge that. But now she's turning stuff around pretty well on the political front. But is it a risky gambit?
It's, well, I don't know that she really has any choice but to try it. you want to try to win. And I don't think Pelosi's wrong to say that New York is in a significant way to blame for the Democrats not controlling the House, and I think that the performance of the party has been extraordinarily poor on a statewide level. We've pointed this out in editorials over the last few years, particularly when it came to the constitutional amendments that they tried to get through on voting, absentee voting and same-day registration, I think, was the other one. And the Democrats just thought, well, who would vote against that? The Republicans rather masterfully mustered. Use that as one of the issues to get people out, and they defeated it. And I'm you know, it looked early on like this was going to happen with the Equal Rights Amendment as well, that all the confusion surrounding it in terms of what exactly it says and the fact that it doesn't, you know, directly talk about abortion on the ballot measure, and they lost in court to clarify what the ERA is going to say and accomplish, you know, starting to look like a repeat of the earlier constitutional amendment battle. You know, if Hochul is doing what she says she's doing and what the story says she's doing, if she is accomplishing all that, well, the proof will be in November. We won't have to wait long to find out. And the one thing that is clear is that the Democrats cannot, especially on a statewide basis or on a congressional delegation basis, take their enrollment edge statewide for granted anymore.
Mike?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, before President Biden decided to leave the race, there were some people saying that New York might even be in contention for Trump to win. I don't think so. I think the numbers in New York City and in the cities across upstate that are always very solidly Democratic would have made that impossible. But the fact that it would even be discussed, you got to remember, though, New York has had lots of Republican governors, you know, going back to Dewey and Rockefeller, and then you had more recently Pataki. It's not an impossibility that a moderate Republican and somebody like Mike Lawler, a new congressman, if he's to succeed and win a second term, he'd be in a very, very good position to challenge Hochul. And the Democrats would be, you know, hard-pressed to find somebody maybe and try to, you know, who knows? The Attorney General was always thought, Letitia James was always thought to be interested in, you know, running for governor. That might happen. She might, Kathy Hochul, the governor, might have challenges from within the party. It's her decision seemed to backfire on her. She's getting a lot of heat from her decision to suspend the, you know, at the last minute, suspend the implementation of the congestive pricing in New York City, where you'll get charged a toll to go into Midtown and Lower Manhattan. And the MTA is now struggling to pay the bills because that was going to generate a lot of revenue for it. And she said she's going to make a decision somewhere along the way. It was highly contentious anyway, because the Hudson Valley commuters and the Long Island commuters were very opposed to it. And she seems to have an ability to stick her foot into a lot of controversies that end up backfiring on her, and her popularity on the Siena College polls just seems to be so-so. She's vulnerable.
Fran, anything you'd like to add?
From over in Massachusetts, how does it look?
Hey, I'm kind of happy with where we are. you guys know I'm a public interest technologist, so you know, to me, it just speaks to a systemic problem of our system, and maybe Hochul's lack of nuanced handling of how she deals with this problem, which is when you're elected, you're purportedly kind of supposed to purport the public interest. But of course, in these kinds of positions, hers and Biden's and lots of other people's, they're also the leader of their party. And their party wants to win. Otherwise, they don't get to do their agenda. So it sounds like, and you guys know so much more about this than I do, not just because you live in New York, but I mean, it sounds like she's sort of struggling with how she handles her own public interest leadership and how she handles the party, and that she did not before and is still not doing this in a particularly nuanced and delicate way. But it's a hard fence to walk on. And our political system makes that so. It's not just her competence or lack thereof.
And she does face a very, you know, she faces both the business community and the Republican Party on, you know, the other big thing she retreated on, or at least has taken a pause on, is the climate Climate Act that she's brought in people to, she's brought together she did a summit recently to begin talking about, well, you know, are we ready for this? Will we be ready for it? Can we keep up with the timeline? You know, this has been the Republican narrative and the business narrative for quite some time. And they leapt on it. I mean, they're putting out, they kind of have doubled down at this point to try to say, in some cases, well, maybe we should just scrap the whole thing. And we should be doing more gas plants and more, you know, and build nuclear. And maybe we should be doing the green energy thing because it's going to be so expensive. You know, it's... the Republicans are really on game in New York, and she is faced, I think, politically, and to this point, that she's faced with trying to keep the suburbs, trying to keep the people who are on the fence politically, and could go either way. So congestion pricing, you know, it makes perfect sense that she would say, maybe not. You know, I don't want to lose Long Island. I don't want to lose Westchester or Orange County, I think, was concerned about it. And the same thing with everybody being told that, you know, she's going to take away our gas stoves, which I do love. I just can't get convection.
I understand.
Conductive is conductive. The one. Yeah, that's the alternative.
The alternative.
Now, as far though as the as Nancy Pelosi and watching these races and obviously not liking what she sees, it was a situation in New York that many felt was avoidable.
Right. I mean, what happened was they lost four seats that could have gone the other way, and they were close races, and a couple of them were in the Hudson Valley, and now. Two of those are being refought. You know, we're talking about the Mike Lawler seat. He's from Rockland County, so it's lower Hudson Valley. And then you have the Congressman Marcus Molinaro of Dutchess County, whose district kind of shoots across the river and into central New York even. And, you know, they're trying to make a race out of that one. And a lot of money is being spent by Democrats to win back a couple of those seats. And... you know, it might benefit from a big turnout if Harris is be able to, you know, get New York on the map again and be a you know, help change the what happens in Congress, who wins.
And those two in particular, I think, are walking a fine line between, you know, loyalty to the conference, loyalty to Trump. And distance from Trump and distance from the Freedom Caucus and the extremists in there, you know, and dealing with, you know, the person who I think could arguably be called the dean of New York's Republican delegation at this point, Elise Stefanik, who is perfectly safe in her district as far as I can tell. You know, the thing to think about to me is,
you know, imagine Elise Stefanik, God forbid, was the governor and, you know, had this basically same set of issues. Does she want to promote her party both in the state and at the federal level? And does she want to kind of push more public interest things out of the way because they don't sell as well? And you know, my guess is, but correct me if I'm wrong, we'd be all over her. On the round table. You know, how could you do this? It's against the public interest. You know, how could you promote, you know, Republicans in Congress? I mean, to me, and maybe I'm more of a centrist than many people who come on round table, but, you know, I just think, like, it's not like different rules apply to Democrats and Republicans. And if Democrats get a leg up, we're really delighted about it, but like somehow it's not okay for Republicans to get a leg up. I mean, to me, these are systemic problems, and they're systemic problems that get in the way of us doing what the public sector's mission is, which is to promote the interests of the public, which I know is completely Pollyanna-ish and Jill will send me a polite and loving email after this saying, your time at the round table is done, Fran.
Really?
But, well, Fran. Really?
Oh, no. Fran, we want Pollyanna. That's the Fran I know.
Yeah, that's what we need. That's what we all need.
Well, to Fran's point there, you know, what's going on in Springfield is a really good example of
Springfield, Ohio.
Yeah. There is a way to govern and there is a way not to govern. The way to govern and to serve the public interest is to have an intelligent discussion, a thoughtful discussion about what are the problems caused by, 12 or 20,000 immigrants coming into a community, welcomed into the community, by the way, by officials who wanted a labor force to match the economic development effort that they were doing. And, that's one way to handle it. And the other way to handle it is to have this wild rhetoric about, paint them as illegal, paint them as pet-eating monsters. And, and that's the problem. So how would, let's say, an Elise Stefanik govern New York? God, I think God forbid is exactly the right.
We should say that phrase. Elise Stefanik has not indicated that she's interested in running.
I think
for
she
governor
would like to be governor. I think if she can't be vice president, governor would be the next best thing.
Okay, perhaps you're correct, but I think.
Okay, now you're grossing me out. I just want to point out.
Lee Zeldin.
I started it. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Please know Pollyanna grossed out.
Yeah, Lee Zeldin, who was the Republican candidate against Kathy Hochul in the last gubernatorial election in New York, was not a good candidate. I mean, he was not a New York Republican, a moderate New York Republican. If somebody like Marcus Molinaro, who had run for governor against Andrew Cuomo years ago, had run against Kathy Hochul, I think he might have been the governor now. Instead, he ran for Congress and in a very close election was elected to Congress. But, I mean, I think what you need is a traditional middle-of-the-road Republican like George Pataki was, hearkening back to the days when Rockefeller Republicans were common in New York, people with somewhat of a middle-of-the-road liberal perspective but fiscally conservative. And that I think a good candidate like that will be very difficult for Democrats to win against in 2 years if Kathy Hochul is the standard bearer.
We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Erica says, I'm so disappointed with the governor's performance thus far. I don't see much from her, and what I do see is her trying to appease too many arms of each political party. She needs to take a page from Big Gretch, I believe that's Gretchen Whitmer, governor of Michigan.
Michigan.
Don't feel close enough to refer to her as Big Gretch. We are going to turn people purple before you know it. That idea of turning people purple, especially in New York?
Well, I mean, if you look at the maps.
Only if everybody in New York gets to look like Barney.
There you go. Right. Yeah.
There you go.
I love you. You love me. We're a part of a happy family. Go ahead, Mike.
No. I was just kind of agreeing. It's true. It's not so purple. It's very blue and very red. Very close next to each other. I mean, you go up the Northway, and there's sections that are red as red can be, and you go up the Northway, you see that, Joe. And yet, on another side, you'll have Saratoga Springs right down through the Capital Region, down the Hudson Valley, and it's very blue. It's New York is blue and red. It's not so purple. I mean, there's a lot of places that are one or the other.
I think to your point from before about the concern that New York might flip and might be in play in the presidential election if Biden had been a candidate, I do think there were a lot of Democrats that felt that way.
Yeah, I don't know that it was true, but it would have been, even if it was close in New York and Biden only won it by a little while, it would be a big boon for Republicans.
Yeah. Yeah. But it would. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. You have maybe 30 seconds.
It would. I think it isn't so much flipping Democrats. I think it's a matter of turnout. So if you don't, if people aren't enthusiastic, and that's, I think, the problem that Hochul is facing, if people aren't enthusiastic, or the challenge she's facing, then they're not going to turn out. And that's where the Republican lack of an edge becomes less so. I guess that's an awkward way of putting it.
I got it, though.
Yeah. All right, it gets closer.
We'll pause there when we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We will finish up our time together. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. A few more minutes with our group here, and we'd love for you to join us, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. One of the other stories that I kind of slipped in under the radar here, which I thought was important that I wanted to talk about, is what's happening in Canada, our neighbor to the north, don't you know? The Mike is fresh from Canada, so we don't have Kristen Van Genhoven, our resident Canadian, but we do have Mike, who is just in Canada. So that's we'll have to do on this Tuesday morning. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and the Liberal Party. The Liberal Party of Justin Trudeau has lost a parliament seat it had held for decades in a special election in Montreal, a devastating defeat that is likely to increase pressure on Canada's deeply unpopular leader to resign. A national party that supports independence for Quebec narrowly won the race that was held on Monday, according to final results released early this morning. It was the Liberals' second stunning election loss in 3 months. The result underscored how support for the Liberals has evaporated, even in their last few strongholds, ahead of the next general election, which must be held by the fall of 2025, but is likely to take place in the spring. Mr. Trudeau has pledged to lead his party in that election, saying over the weekend that he would not quit, even if the Liberals lost on Monday. Mr. Trudeau told reporters in Ottawa on Tuesday morning that there's all sorts of reflections to take on the election outcome. Obviously, it would have been nicer to be able to win, Mr. Trudeau said, but there's more work to do, and we're going to stay focused on doing it. The defeat could set up an end game for Mr. Trudeau's third term in office. The main opposition Conservative Party is likely to redouble its efforts to quickly bring down his government, as polls predict the Conservatives cruising to a landslide in the next election. For the past year, Mr. Trudeau's approval ratings have stagnated just above 20% and trailed those of the Conservative leader by double digits. Mike.
Well, I should preface this by saying I have just been on a week off in Canada, and including Montreal, where this special election happened. But I wasn't there on a political journey. But it's true. It is amazing.
Journeys are political.
Yes, that's true. Just from the perspective of an American looking at Canada, you know, we don't follow Canada the way they follow us. If you run into a Canadian and start chatting with them, they know more about the U.S. than you, 10 times more about the U.S. and politics, et cetera, than we do about Canada. And don't even ask an American about geography of Canada. They couldn't name all the provinces or anything, you know. Having said all that, Justin Trudeau has been a very popular leader outside of Canada since he's taken office. And he was very popular when he took over, but that has waned clearly as the Conservatives have gained more momentum, and he's in trouble politically. I like him. I mean, I think he's always seemed very moderate and very welcoming. You know, Canada has, depending on who you talk to, has been welcoming to immigrants. They do require some some standards that they've set, but they don't seem to have the problem that the U.S. seems to have accepting people from other nations. And but in any event, he's popular throughout Europe. He was sort of standing alongside the NATO leaders, during the last summits in Europe, and he seems to just be more popular elsewhere than he is at home. So it would behoove us to pay a little bit closer to the place. It's only what, 150 miles north of us?
Yeah. Not far.
Nope.
Not far at all.
Not being an expert on Canadian politics, just from what I know of this race, I there's a lot. I think there's a lot of nuance here. I think they had an unpopular candidate, an unlikable candidate that he handpicked out of a field of three that were going to primary them. That was supposed to be an open competition for the Liberal line. Quebec is a very Quebec-centric mentality.
French.
And
very
it was,
French.
Yeah. And it was a Quebec, the new Quebecois candidate, I think, is the one who won. He could still eke out a life, a political life here with the right coalition. But I think Mike's right. He seems more popular in the rest of the world than he is there, and that is not helping. And it doesn't help to pick a candidate that has the same sense of detachment or air of detachment that you have.
It's choice. Funny, over the years I've gone up to Quebec a few times, not a lot, but it seems like it's more French this mm-hmm. time. People are polite, and when you say, parlez-vous anglais,
that is more French.
Yeah, but I mean, someone told me about Jim Gaffigan, the comedian, who says, Quebec, Canadians are supposed to be so nice, but in Quebec they're French. How does that work? But anyway, I shouldn't say that, but I just did, so that's over there. But it is. It's fascinating to watch why a popular politician can't get a foothold and is struggling to get a consensus. I guess that's...
Yeah. Well, we may be writing his obituary soon. This may be
political
obituary. Part of the French-Canadian, for lack of a better word, British-Canadian divide that we saw here, as opposed to a referendum on Trudeau, even though everybody seems to be painting it that way, or all the smart people are anyway.
Speaking of smart people, Fran, what do you think?
Boy, I wish I knew more about Canadian politics. All I know is that from the, million-mile foot view, it always looks more civilized and more discussive than ours. But I don't know, when you get into it, maybe it looks differently. I've always loved Canada, actually. Canada, I have been all over the world, especially in a previous job. And people would say, oh, Fran, you've been to so many places. What's your favorite foreign country? And I would always say Canada. I actually love Canada. I've been to a lot of places in it, and I find that, people always are, civilized, thoughtful, and, shall we say, nice. But in terms of Trudeau, I am listening eagerly to hear the benefit of everybody else's wisdom, because I feel like I don't understand his political situation enough to weigh in with, any usefulness to this conversation.
That is okay. We understand. We have other topics. But thank you. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and as always, we would love to hear from you. Let's go to, for a moment, that I'm just wondering, well, let's do this one. I think we have time. Yes,
so
we have proper
time.
There are some good stories. I want to do the Amazon story. Amazon telling the staff to return to the office 5 days a week. And this is a story because it is Amazon, But it is also a story that is about big tech as they are facing this now. Let's go back to work, even though we have the technology that you don't have to. And so Amazon tells the staff to return to the office 5 days a week. The chief executive, Andy Jassy, told employees the new policy will take effect in January. It's the first of the big tech companies to require a full week in office post-pandemic. Jassy announced the news in a message to employees, telling them they will be expected to follow the new policy beginning January 2nd. Before the change, Amazon employees were required to be in the office 3 days a week. When we look back over the last 5 years, we continue to believe that the advantage of being together in the office are significant. Jassy's note to staff said, "We've observed that it's easier for our teammates to learn, model, practice, and strengthen our culture. Collaborating, brainstorming, and inventing are simpler and more effective, teaching and learning from one another and more seamless, and teams tend to be better connected to one another." Fran, what do you think?
I think it's interesting. I mean, on the face of it, it's kind of a nothing burger article because a lot of people are worried about this, and some people are getting people back in the office full time, and some people are going, you know, completely remote. On the face of it, the fact that Amazon, a very big company, is doing this, you know, is not so noteworthy. But in a way, it really talks about sort of a bigger theme that we struggle with, which is sort of the work versus life theme. And Amazon is trying to optimize, as they should, because they're in the work space, they're trying to optimize work. And people have done a lot of studies about this. And, of course, you get a lot of convenience and you get a lot of flexibility by working remotely. But it's harder to create those kinds of intangibles that go for deeper engagement and creativity and kind of effectiveness online, just online. I mean, we see that with social media. I mean, we have a lot of, and now I'm putting them in air quotes, but you can't see it, relationships with people in social media, but they're not real relationships. I mean, they're not real relationships in the sense of the people that you get close to when you're actually physically present. And that's true of work, too. I mean, arguably, when you're physically present, you can bring a lot more to the workspace. On the other hand, all of us have kind of gotten used to making our lives more important, and the pandemic did that. And so now we have arrangements that involve, you know, daycare and home offices and all kinds of things. And that makes it possible for us to work. It gives us other work options. So Amazon is coming down to say, we care about your engagement at work. We think it's better if you're all there, and we're going to tell you to do that, and we can because we're Amazon. And but I think sort of the bigger picture about how do you work best? When do you need engagement in order to improve either your work or your life? Those are really important issues, and we're kind of in a pretty experimental period because of the pandemic. Because the pandemic forced us all home, and we all discovered, oh my God, you know, do I really want to spend 24/7 here? Do I want to redecorate? Do I want to move? Do I want to live with different people? We made a lot of decisions, and those are not over.
Anybody want 75 seconds to respond?
Yeah, I find it compelling that, the justification for this new policy at Amazon is that they contend it's easier for teammates to learn and model and practice, as you read, Joe, you know, and brainstorm and create. And it says that creativity and learning is more seamless. I kind of agree. I think in certain kinds of work, being able to just turn to the person next to you and say, you know, hey, Larry, how did that go? You know, when you did that and I'm having this problem here, can you help me? It's not something you do very well online. I'm sure you can text people or call people, but there is a collaborative benefit to that kind of work. And yet other kinds of work, like accounting work, billing, maybe some other data work, over online sales work, et cetera, you might be able to do from your home, and the benefits are enormous to you. You cannot live where you have to, where your employer is.
We'll end there on this Tuesday morning. My thanks to our wonderful group, Fran Berman, Jay Jacknowitz, and Mike Spain. Thank you all. Great to have you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
I will bottle up all my comments for the next time.
All right. And you can just, we'll uncork
I'll
it and you can
you
go
remotely.
Off on 5 days a week. That's right. We'll be back right after this.